Father, in your generosity, you give to us the scriptures. You give us minds to think. You give us hearts to respond. So bless us now, Lord. Open our eyes. Open our minds. Warm our hearts. For Jesus' sake. Amen. And congratulations to you on braving the weather and the gloom. Nice to see you. Now, I wonder, do you have a favourite word? A word that you use frequently? Or maybe it's a favourite phrase? You may not be able to answer for yourself, but no doubt there are other people close to you who can tell you what those words or phrases are. And in this letter, Paul certainly has a favourite phrase and a favourite word. His phrase is the one that begins our reading this morning. What shall we say then? You might paraphrase it as, where do we go from here? A quick count suggests that in that form, or in an abbreviated version, Paul uses that phrase some 8 times in Romans. Sometimes it's to introduce another question, to which the answer is usually an emphatic no. So, for example, in chapter 6 and verse 1, he says, what shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning that grace may increase? No! There he was anticipating an objection that might be raised to an earlier assertion of his, where he'd said, where sin increased, grace increased all the more. Shall we go on sinning then? No. On other occasions, he uses it to move the argument on. And here in chapter 9, verse 30, he uses it to introduce his summary of all that he has said up until now, and especially what he has said in chapter 9. And he offers his summary in the next 3 verses. What shall we say then? That the Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have obtained it, a righteousness that is by faith. But Israel, who pursued a law of righteousness, has not attained it. Why not? Because they pursued it not by faith, but as if it were by works. And that's where his favourite word comes in. If you look through verses 30 to 32, you spot it immediately. And in the short passage that we had read just now, it occurs 6 times. Actually, it occurs 7 times, but the NIV has dropped out 1. Very nearly a quarter of the total number of instances where he uses that word in the entire letter. The word, of course, is righteousness. But righteousness is not a word that we use very often in normal conversation, is it? We're more familiar with it in combination with the word self. Self-righteousness. And since self-righteousness is not a very attractive feature amongst human beings, I suspect that we are at best somewhat suspicious of the word righteousness. So just supposing that you are asked to explain what the word means, I have a hunch that most of us would find ourselves struggling a little. Yes, go on. Ask yourself how you would explain that word to someone else. Actually, it's not terribly helpful to ask for an explanation, certainly not if we want is a definition. And that is because, to a very large extent, what any particular word means is determined by its context, by the way in which it is being used. Most of the time we don't have to think about it. But there are plenty of words that can change their meaning substantially according to their context. So if I ask, can you hear me? I could be asking if I am audible. But I might be asking if anyone is listening to me. I might be asking if I am being understood, if you get it. I might even be asking if anyone has the slightest intention of taking any notice of what I'm saying. So when we come to the word righteousness in Romans, its context is usually the relationship between humans and God. But it seems to have a different emphasis, a different shade of meaning, depending on whether it is being used in relation to God or whether it is being used in relation to humans. If we are to understand it, we need to recognize that when it is used of human beings, it is not primarily to do with whether we are good people or not. It's not about moral judgments. And when it is used of God, it is not in the first instance a moral judgment either. When it is used of God, it is a way of speaking of his utter consistency. The righteousness of God, his utter consistency. God reaches out to human beings in a totally reliable manner, utterly faithful to his part in any relationship with us. He does not renege on his promises, nor on his love. And when it is used of human beings, it refers to our being in a right relationship with God. The fancy way of speaking about that is to talk about a covenant relationship, in which God, in his love and mercy, binds himself to us, and we are bound to God. And that's the central point of Romans. That relationship between us and God, what it is based on, and what its consequences are. So Paul asks, what shall we say then? What are we going to say in the light of the fact that so many of my fellow Jews have failed to enter into this relationship with God that you Gentiles have? Put simply, Paul says, it is because my fellow Jews have got things upside down, meaning back to front. They have so much baggage with them in the shape of the law and their various religious customs that they have failed to grasp the fact that it is not a matter of striving to earn a relationship with God, but rather of reaching out and accepting it as a pure gift. And that is just so human, isn't it? We don't want to feel under obligation to anyone else. We like to earn support, or the respect, or the position, or the influence, or indeed something more concrete that we have. We like to convince ourselves that everything is a matter of merit. And if we want to be in with God, we'll earn it, thank you very much. We'll prove ourselves. We'll work our socks off to acquire divine approval. But God simply says, come to me. Even when we have understood that, we constantly slip back into the old way of thinking. We must try harder. So what we do is not out of delight at being accepted by God, but in order to earn his favour. The law was God's gift to his people. His gift to the people with whom he had established the covenant relationship at Sinai. His gift to help them to understand what was involved in this new relationship. But because of their failure to understand that, the law ceased to be a gift and became a burden. Or rather, it became a rock, which instead of being a sure foundation, became something that they stumbled over. So you see in verse 33, Paul quotes from Isaiah, "See, I lay in Zion a stone that causes men to stumble, a rock that makes them fall. And the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame." That verse is just a little bit puzzling, isn't it? And it's puzzling because it weaves together two verses from Isaiah. The first few words where he says, "See, I lay in Zion a stone," comes from Isaiah 28. But then he leaves out a few words and continues with, "The one who trusts in him will never be put to shame." That's Isaiah 28. The middle bit about stumbling and falling comes from Isaiah 8, from a very different context. The point then is that God has put in place something that is utterly reliable, his consistency. But for some, that is something that they simply can't cope with, so they trip over it. So at the beginning of chapter 10, Paul returns to the theme that he took up a chapter earlier, his longing that his people would grasp what it is that God has done for them. "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved." He has this longing that his people would grasp what it is that God has done. It's not that they are apathetic. It's not that they are hostile. Indeed, as he says in verse 2, it's just that they haven't understood. They haven't understood that all that they have to do is to surrender themselves to God. That's all that any of us have to do. It is the most gloriously simple truth. And paradoxically, the hardest truth for many of us to understand. So Paul concludes in verse 4 that Christ is the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness, that is to say, a relationship with God, for everyone who believes. And Paul is using that word "end" with two senses. On the one hand, the Greek word for that is translated "end" means goal. Christ is the goal of the law. If you like, that's where the law is pointing to, it pointing to Christ. As Jesus himself said, "I didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it." If you like, to enable you to see what it's all about. Because properly understood, the law is concerned with the relationship which is established by God. So move on from treating the law as the way to get right with God, and understand that it is the guide to how those of us who are enjoying that relationship should live it out in daily life. But Christ is also the end of the law in another sense. That is to say, he breaks the stranglehold that the law has come to have over Paul's compatriots. So does all of this have any relevance to us and to our Jewish neighbours? Graham quite rightly emphasised a couple of weeks ago that Romans is not to be read as telling us what we ought to think about the nation of Israel as it is today. Nonetheless, Romans does demand of us that we think through very carefully how we to relate to the Jewish people in general, and also to the nation Israel. The sad truth is that over the centuries, there has been a deeply hostile attitude among many Christians towards the Jewish people. For centuries, Christians held the Jews to be corporately responsible for the crucifixion of Christ. And in consequence, they were disparaged, insulted, vilified, and persecuted. Forced into limited areas of business life, they came to be hated because they were actually successful at much of it. They were expelled from Britain in the year 1290. 2 centuries later, they were expelled from Spain. And all that long before the discrimination and persecution that they suffered in France, in Austria, in Germany, in Russia, and elsewhere during the 19th and 20th centuries. And now we are seeing fresh waves of anti-Semitism, prompted particularly by the actions of Israel in Gaza. And that hostility has been there even though there are many Jewish people who repudiate the actions of the current Israeli government. Over the centuries, Christians have not exactly covered themselves with glory in enabling the Jewish people to discover the riches of God's mercy. So the question for us is, can we ally ourselves with Paul's longing and his prayer, and do so with humility and with contrition? Can we lend our support in whatever ways to those of our Christian brothers and sisters who are seeking to provide support for Jewish congregations and individuals who feel themselves to be under threat? But when we said that, Paul's longing and prayer for his people does not require that we endorse the ambitions and the actions of the government of Israel. It does not require that we condone either the wholesale destruction of Gaza, nor the illegal attempts of Israeli settlers to seize Palestinian villages and land in the West Bank, nor the collusion in those actions and the violence that accompanies them of the Israeli Defence Force and the Israeli police. We hear little about that. But if you're not already aware, it is truly awful. And however much sympathy we may have for the desire of the Israeli people to enjoy security, and that is a perfectly proper desire, are not those Palestinians to be numbered among the Gentiles who are just as much the objects of God's love and mercy? So we include them in our prayers too, because God's righteousness, his utter consistency, holds out his love and mercy to draw us into relationship with him, regardless of who we are.